Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlossophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlossophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villeneuve, and alongside me, as always, are the dynamic duos, Chad Riley. I almost said Shad. Chad Riley and Spencer Oy. Williams.
Way to fuse our names together.
Fusion! No.
He no longer sees two people, he just sees one. Well, you guys, the entire episode cross-eyed.
That might just be, but we do have a great show in store as we're going to be talking about the upcoming film Ocean's 8, so stick around. But before we do, Chad, let them know what's up.
Maybe I will. Like a multi-million dollar heist, nearly 6 years in the making, the Filmlossophers podcast is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. We stream new episodes each week on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom. It's a little team we like to call Filmlossopher 7.
Nah.
Not really, but we try to embrace the whole, like, numbering down thing instead of up thing. Spencer, where else can they find us?
You don't have to plan a long con just to fence some good ideas. Our social pages are a much easier mark. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlossophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlossophy101 to join in on the conversation.
Talk to us!
We're lonely. Finally, you can access our entire library of enriching content on our website at filmlossophers.com.
That's right. If you head over to filmlossophers.com, you can catch all 114 episodes. We are 114 episodes into this podcast.
115. This says 116 in these notes.
Oh, 115? Sorry.
This says 116. And plus, we've got extra content coming out our ears.
That's
right. We are nothing if not prolific.
Absolutely.
With the content.
Prolific. You hear that, Spence?
Yes.
Say it with me. Prolific.
No.
Darn it. So if you have the
Shot
chance
down.
Nothing new here. So if you head over to our website, you can check out all of our previous episodes and give them a listen. But as we said, we are here to talk about the upcoming film, the dynamic, what's a seven, what's the Latin number for seven, like they have trio, duo.
Oh gosh, I don't know that there'd be a the
how often is there seven of something?
No, they wouldn't.
Well,
I don't know what it would be. I didn't take Latin. I speak English real good.
Well, I don't know why I got seven because there's eight. Ocean.
I don't know. Either.
Yeah, why are we talking about seven?
The octet.
Ocho.
The dynamic octet.
Yeah.
Ocean's 8, the film that is set to debut this weekend, this upcoming weekend, actually. We got a chance to check out a press screening of this film. And so, we actually went to the theater and well, okay, let me take
a
step back.
As we tend to do when we see movies.
That's true.
We go to the theater.
Taking a step back, we actually did a little homework. So we'll get into this a little later, but
gosh.
Spencer and I... and. Chad had the better frame of mind to move forward and not...
I was there in spirit.
But Spencer and I kind of plowed through...
But I didn't dedicate my time to it.
The first three films in one day. So we'll go over that in a little bit. But before we do, Chad, give him that official synopsis.
Ooh, I got that for you. Danny Ocean's estranged sister, Debbie Ocean, played by Sandra Bullock, attempts to pull off the heist of the century at New York City's star-studded annual Met Gala. Her first stop is to assemble the perfect crew, starting with her partner in crime, Lou Miller, played by Kate Blanchett. Together, they recruit a team of specialists. Jeweler Amita, played by Mindy Kaling. Street con Constance, played by Awkwafina.
Mm-hmm.
Expert fence Tammy, played by Sarah Paulson. Hacker Nineball, played by Rihanna. And fashion designer Rose, played by Helena Bonham Carter. The target? A gorgeous diamond necklace that's been in Cartier's most secure vault for 50 years. The jewelry will be on prominent display at the Met Gala on the neck of world-famous actress Daphne Kluger, played by Anne Hathaway.
That is right. Directed by Gary Ross, the film stars, as Chad said, Sandra Bullock, Kate Blanchett, Anne Hathaway, Mindy Kaling, Sarah Paulson, Awkwafina, Rihanna, Helena Bonham Carter, Damian Lewis, Richard Armitage, James Corden, and many others.
Kind of the way you blended Spencer and I, you just kind of ran a bunch of those names together.
Oh, 100%. This is a Hispanic person.
Uncross your eyes, man. Uncross them.
This film is the fourth film in the modernized franchise by Steven Soderbergh that began back in 2001. The third film in the series, Ocean's 13, was released in 2007. In her 2001 book, Mindy Kaling actually expressed an interest in wanting to do a reboot of the Ocean's 11 film called Ocean's 5 that would have featured an all-female cast.
Well, she got her wish, didn't she?
Well,
and
that
even with a few three extra people.
With two.
No.
Three. No, why am I still thinking seven?
Spencer, just take over. Just take over.
Go ahead, Spence. I'm done. I'm going to go home. eight. Ocean's 8. I remember. Ocean's 8. Okay. So
Do you actually remember? I don't know.
So we just got back from Ocean 7.
Did we?
Did we?
No, we didn't.
Look at that.
I'm like looking at
that's
you like
genuine confusion on the man's face. Ocean's 8.
You know what?
Basically what you're saying is one of these ladies doesn't matter to you.
Ooh, which one?
Which one did you dislike the most that you've totally forgotten she was even there? And was that part of the con?
Ooh. Wow. All right, back on track. So we went.
No, answer the question.
I don't know.
Well, then stop calling them seven. There are eight of them.
Ocean's 8. Ocean's
They already
eight.
Downsized from the last time. 13 to 8. That's a diminishment of how many, Eddie? 13
Five.
Minus 8 equals. Ooh, nice job.
Well, you got that one.
Hey.
I did something right in school.
I'm impressed.
So off of me
Just
and onto
don't ask
the film.
The man to read.
It's true. We got a chance to see Ocean's 8 this week, and we were actually quite surprised as going into the film and checking it out. Like I said, Spencer and I took the time to plow through three films over 6 hours worth of time in a single day to prep, because not because I hadn't seen any of these films, but because Spencer hadn't even heard of any of these
films. Okay, that's not true. I've heard of Ocean's 11.
Well, he hadn't seen any of them, and he'd had over 17 years to see these films.
Okay, now you can do math.
Math wasn't the issue. It was reading. So we actually sat through and we binged these three movies, and it was actually kind of interesting watching Spencer go through each individual film.
So you literally have never seen, like, even on like television broadcast or anything, you've never seen any of those three.
Nope.
So you basically in, well, 2 days time, really, mm-hmm. You saw all four.
Yes.
That's going to be interesting to talk about.
Yeah. Why do you say it like that?
No. We'll get into it later.
His face had like a twinge of disgust for a quick second. It's like, okay. Well, as we said,
this is going to be a good show.
So we got a chance to see those films to kind of prep Spencer's mind as well as refresh mine on what came before. And so just jumping right in, obviously we can just plow right into this. What were some of your guys' expectations of the film? Now, knowing that Spencer had seen all three and is probably the most freshest perspective out of all three of us here at this table, I would like to start with Spencer.
Okay.
Now, knowing your vast knowledge of the Oceans franchise, what were your expectations coming into this film?
Well, first off, I'd probably like just to throw out there as a general warning to people.
Uh-oh.
Do not binge watch three movies. If you like are quizzed on it later, you're not going to know what happened in which movie. Like, I know I can remember events, but I have no idea like which oceans that happened in.
It's true. We finished Ocean's 12, and we paused before the next film, and I turned to Spencer, and I was like, "So, Spencer, are you following along so far?" He's like, I think I know what's happened. I just don't know who." I'm like, "So you know who Rusty is? You know who Danny is? You know who?" And he's like, "Nope, I have no idea who these people are.
No idea who anyone is actually called." It's like, "Oh, you've got Don Cheadle. You've got Bernie Mac, and they're planning a robbery." With George Clooney.
Why the only... never mind.
Plus, there's like 12 of them. How do you remember all these people?
There's only Spencer. I don't remember all their names either. I mean, granted, it's been a while longer since I've seen these films.
You got Danny Lotion, Rusty.
No, he's Danny Ocean. He's not Danny Lotion.
No one said Danny Lotion.
You said Danny Lotion.
I said Daniel Ocean. Whatever. Either way.
Danny Lotion.
Danny Lotion. So, recognizing all that.
Yes, yes, yes.
What were your expectations for this film? Obviously, I'm hoping you got a chance to see the trailer. You got a chance to see some of the teaser promos for this.
Yeah, yeah. I saw the trailer for Ocean's 8. And pretty much, like, after I saw the first three, I was like, well, this should have, like, a real Ocean's 11 feel to it, which, you know, I'd say it's pretty true for the movie. It feels kind of like the first one, except, you know.
Now, when you say Ocean's 11, I'm 100% sure there are people that were just like you, Spence, that hadn't seen the film. What is an Ocean's 11 feeling?
Oh, my gosh.
This is a pop quiz.
Okay, so, because I actually had to, like, confront in my mind, where does Ocean's 11 stop in, like, my memory of the entire film franchise?
Well,
it turned into one big movie.
I mean, Ocean's 11, he's establishing his team,
mm-hmm.
right? Yes, and yes. Here, she's establishing her team, some yes. of whom she's known already and some of whom they just find. Like, they find the right person with the skills
mm-hmm.
for what they need them to do.
Yeah, thanks, Chad. That's basically it. So, is that...
I got your back, Spence.
Like, you know...
To Eddie, we're the same person, so...
It's true.
Yeah. Someone has to do...
We're talking out of both sides of our mouth. Just keep crossing your eyes and
all right.
follow along.
All right, so yeah, basically that and, you know, seeing them, like, pull off a heist.
That's what you were expecting?
Yes.
Okay.
Ocean's 11 with Sandra Bullock.
Ocean's 11 with Sandra Bullock. Okay. What about you, Chad? Any expectations?
My greatest expectation, I wouldn't say expectation. My greatest hope was to see Cate Blanchett playing the Rusty role. So... Rusty was Brad Pitt's character in the first sequence of films, and he's the somewhat goofy but also more grounded in some ways person, you know,
yeah.
to counter Danny Ocean. So they both lead to a certain extent, and that clearly was going to be Cate Blanchett's character's function on the team, was Debbie Ocean's counterbalance, if you will. As a leader of the team. So I'm a huge Cate Blanchett fan. You typically see her in I don't want to say normal, like contemporary roles. So she's
yeah.
playing Galadriel or Hela or Bob Dylan or like she's doing a period piece or something that's not just the modern day, something very, you know, very modern. So her whole aesthetic, her vibe in the trailers, I was really looking forward to seeing whatever she was going to do in this movie. Sandra Bullock, I think, was more like maybe a slightly shadier version of most of the characters that she's played before. But Cate Blanchett definitely has that almost chameleon-like ability to really inhabit a character differently per movie, per role.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested to see what she would do, because obviously it's not going to be quirky in the way that Rusty is quirky in the first three films or anything like that, but still has to, you know, do that counterweight kind of role. So that's what I was looking forward to the most.
Now,
also, I was really looking forward to seeing, you know, who is Awkwafina, because with a name like that, it's very memorable and distinctive, but I've never seen her in anything else.
Neither have I. I think she's in another film that
Crazy
I think...
Crazy Rich Asians.
Storks.
Yeah.
I was going to say that. What?
She's in Storks.
She's in Storks?
Yes.
That's a cartoon.
Is that a cartoon? That's a cartoon,
yeah.
isn't it?
Oh. Well, so her voice is in Storks.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I was going to say...
Her face is in Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah. She's she plays like a sister or something.
Yeah. She's the one with the blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I've seen her in the trailers. All right. Well, in terms of my expectations, in terms of for this particular film, one of the biggest things I was expecting was the likeness of how this film parallels the previous trilogy. There's a very unique style and even unique language of how the first trilogy, because I don't want to say original trilogy, because it's not the original trilogy. It's not even the original film. The original film was done back in the 60s. But in terms of the current, more modern day trilogy, there's a certain way that they go about, you know, just to the most finest point, just talking to each other. you know, whether if it's through the certain banter that they have, the style of how they dress, the style of how they look. And I wasn't looking for so much as to like how close it was to that, but having those aspects, those particulars being unique to this film.
Well, because it is a challenge. You've only got, it's one thing to say, I'm going to do, let's say, you know, Lost, right? Mm-hmm. Which is an ensemble television series. And yeah. So you've got 1 to 2 dozen characters that you're keeping track of, but you've got 20 or so hours per season to keep track of them. In a movie like this, you've got a dozen characters in 2 hours or less, and you really need to be able to keep track of them within the first 30 minutes or so. So it's one of the challenges and really fun opportunities of, you know, an upbeat ensemble film like this, where you've got distinctive looks, you've got distinctive names, characteristics, and like you said, the banter. If you do it right, it comes across really, really fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's very unique that you say that, because not only do you have to follow all 8+ individuals that are in, take the first trilogy, like 11+, but in this one, 8+, not only do you have to follow the movements and whatnot and the whereabouts of the 8 people that are in this film, but you also have to see them follow through on their precise movements of the overall heist. So they still have to follow through with what their role is and all that, while still tracking in the film and making it all make sense.
Yeah, you definitely don't have double coverage on this team. Mm-mm. The way that you did in Ocean's 11, in terms of, you know, the drivers / waiters, Casey Affleck and Scott Caan.
Yeah.
Or Caan. Caan! you know, but like they kind of were two sides of the same coin. Like it was a dual role, single function kind of thing. Here, each of these women has a specific function that only she does.
So that was honestly my biggest expectation. Aside from that, like I said, seeing if anybody was going to reprise a role, if, you know, what we saw in the trailers was true with, you know, the mausoleum wall, is that actually, you know, the resting place of Daniel Ocean, all that kind of stuff you see in the trailer, and it's like, okay, I'm hoping to still see a lot of the people that I recognized in previous films, and hopefully they make a cameo. So, but,
well, yeah, I mean, with 11, 12, 13, yeah. 15, 20 of them over the course of the 3 films, when you count significant others and whatnot, I mean, any number of performers could make a cameo in this one.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm.
Even if Mr. Lotion is, you know, in the mausoleum.
You know what? But I think, too, the fact that this film takes place pretty much like 11 years after the last film, you know, you've created enough of a gap in terms of waiting that this film needs to pay off in dividends in terms of what it's going to do for the franchise, or else it's kind of not going to... I mean, it needs those merits, in my mind, to pay off, or it's just another heist film. I mean, probably a well-done heist film, but in order for it to be attributed to the Oceans franchise, I think it has to kind of excel beyond just your typical...
In terms of the story, you mean? Not that it has to incorporate any of the characters
from those
other movies.
No, I just mean like in terms of the type of heist film, the
length. It has to feel consistent.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Which I really feel like this movie was, like, consistent in the theme of the other ones, like, in tone.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. And so jumping in, obviously we get introduced to the characters. We get introduced to Sandra Bullock's character,
Debbie
Ocean. This film takes place, apparently, years after she's imprisoned and she's let out on parole. We're introduced to the character that Chad was talking about, Kate Blanchett's character.
Lou.
And obviously the film is about these two individuals who gather together a group of specialists in their field, experts in thievery and whatnot. And I think here's one of the things I kind of want to mention. I know Sandra Bullock tends to be that, in so many words, that one note type of actress. But I enjoy seeing her in pretty much just about anything she does. She's for me, she's not like a Julia Roberts. Julia Roberts tends to kind of be in that same frame of mind most of the time. But Sandra Bullock, I don't know. It's interesting for me where seeing Sandra Bullock, I just like her performances better. I don't know. That might just be my preference.
I mean, I think that they're extremely similar. They're, in terms of the types of movies that they did in their early careers, mm-hmm. they paralleled each other pretty strongly. And I would, I mean, it's just they continue to be cast, you know, because people enjoy them. They pay to see them, you know, so. And quite frankly, Julia Roberts has been in this franchise
yeah.
already, so you could have both of them in the same movie.
I'm going to be honest. Like, I frequently get Julia Roberts and Sandra Bullock mixed up.
I don't think you're alone
what?
In that.
Really?
No, like, and I'll think, like, because, like, when I saw the trailers before I saw the movie, I was like, wasn't she in, like, the other two movies or three movies? And that was Julia Roberts.
Yeah, well, because, I mean, honestly, and you run into this, this happens in Hollywood where it's like, well, you kind of have two or three performers that are kind of that are known for a certain style of performance or a mm-hmm. certain level of stature. And if one of them's not available, you try to go with the other one. And I think for a long time, their careers did that where it's like, well, if Julia Roberts wasn't available, you'd go with Sandra Bullock or vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, and if neither of them was available, then you'd put the project on pause until one of them was available. Yeah. So it's I don't think it's uncommon. I don't think that's an uncommon issue, Spencer.
Sweet.
I was just
I
looking
can
up.
Always tell them apart, but
well, like if I looked at them,
right,
I would
right.
Yes. Well, how else would you try to tell them apart?
No, it's like if you're thinking about it, like
oh,
without,
okay,
like you haven't seen it or
without
seen
visualizing it.
Yes.
Just okay. I'm just making sure.
I'm not saying like I'm looking at a picture of Sandra Bullock and I'm like, is this Sandra Bullock or Julia Roberts?
Well, that's what it felt like to me. That's why I'm like, there's quite the difference. Okay. I just, quick side note, I was checking because I could have swore I thought Julia Roberts might have been older than Sandra Bullock. Actually, Sandra Bullock is older than Julia Roberts. Oh.
Really?
53? Not by much. 53 for Sandra Bullock and 50 for Julia Roberts.
Huh.
So, like,
well, Julia Roberts' career took off earlier,
yeah,
faster,
true.
So that's probably where that feeling comes from. I would have said the same thing, that Julia would be a couple years older, but that's because she got
to her
big a few years before in terms of stardom.
In terms of everybody else that comes along, like we said, you have Mindy Kaling, you have Sarah Paulson, Awkwafina, Rihanna, Helena Bonham Carter.
Rihanna, by the way, who got a tremendous reception in the crowd that we were a part of seeing the press screening of this film. Like, people were loving seeing Rihanna.
I mean, she's an established artist in music. I'm not too sure about her acting.
I would say, not to jump too far ahead,
yeah,
this was one of the most believable performances I've seen from her in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, a dramatic, a fictional character that isn't exactly Rihanna, but kind of is. she wasn't playing herself. She was playing a hacker, a character made for this film. I've seen her in other films, she's lacked believability to me in most of the time. This one, I believed her pretty much the whole time.
Mindy Kaling played Mindy Kaling. I mean, in all honesty,
totally consistent with herself.
I'm not,
nothing wrong with that. I mean,
she's delightful
to watch.
Exactly. And this goes back to kind of like what we were talking about, the Sandra Bullock, Julia Roberts thing. They tend to play themselves, but they're amusing to see on screen. They have that type of appeal. People go to see Julia Roberts play a role. They go to see Sandra Bullock play a role. They go to see Mindy Kaling play a role. They're not looking to see the...
Yeah, there's a reason why those roles make money.
Exactly.
For not only them as performers, but everybody involved on those projects.
And we're not saying that this is solely a female actress thing. Just to kind of put it out there, there are male actors that do the same thing. I mean, we've talked mm-hmm. about this at length with The Rock, with Kevin Hart, with actors like Ice Cube. Mm-hmm. All those individuals who are... They're there because of the fact... Or they have top billing because of the fact that their name carries that type of attention.
Sure.
And I mean, not to say that their acting's horrible, but they're no Daniel Day-Lewis's.
Let's just talk Vin Diesel.
Oh no.
How many times have we gone on about Vin Diesel?
No.
Because it's not exactly acting.
He should be
that happens.
All thought should be removed from his brain and just the three words that he needs to know is I am Groot. Just keep doing that for the rest of his career and he's
delightful.
Good to go. Exactly. That's it. That's all we need. I wanna also say that Helena Bonham Carter's character although it seemed to stretch out from the norm that I was used to seeing with her, because they tried to make her this Irish dressmaker. It was Helena Bonham Carter. You know,
she does that like nobody else. That was
total.
I mean, granted, it's not meant to be an Oscar winning like submersion into character, but that's exactly what she does. I mean, she's been in how many Tim Burton films and done various different versions of characters sort of like that. She does. She disappears into the makeup. She disappears into the accent, and she pulls her weight and then some. I think that she was absolutely one of the most accomplished performers in this ensemble,
mm-hmm.
because where, you know, with a Rihanna, you see Rihanna, with Sandra Bullock, to the, you know, not to discredit her, but like you see Sandra Bullock.
Yeah.
I would say to a certain extent, Cate Blanchett sort of disappeared because of hairstyle and clothing options versus what you're used to seeing her mm-hmm. look like in films. But then Helena Bonham Carter, she kind of looks like this, you know, frumpy, disheveled, highly makeuped person all the time, but they're all different.
Yeah.
So I thought that she did a fine job, you know, with the part that she had to play in the whole thing.
I'm not too familiar with any roles that Sarah Paulson had done prior to this, but I totally believe that she was an at-home mom who was needing to get out of the house. That seemed super believable. I mean, if anything, for me, that particular role, I think I had a little bit more fun with, just seeing as to the depths that they have her go through and for the plan and the heist and everything. But I'm not all too familiar.
What's happening in her garage?
What's happening in her garage? All the things that how she acquires them and whatnot. She's really fun. Like, I think she's a really fun character. I'm just not too aware of a lot of the things that she's done prior to this. So I'm probably, because of this film, I'm probably going to go back and see if I can find some of the stuff that she's done before this.
Well, last film on here is The Post from before Ocean's 8.
Why did she play in The Post?
Some person.
I don't remember. The Post.
And her background, I believe, is in television, if I remember correctly, as well. So she did quite a bit on television before then transitioning into film. I could be wrong about that, but she's been around for a long time, up for awards several times before. She was she got the award. She was Marcia Clark in the O.J. Simpson.
That's right.
TV series
with
John
Gooding.
Travolta and Cuba Gooding Jr. and all that. Yeah. So, yeah, she's done quite a few projects, but I think most of her notable work up until the past, let's say, 8 years or so, it's mostly been television, I believe. But, I think that with what certain characters are doing in this story, we're not going to spoil too much of the plot line of this film, because that's a big part of the joy of seeing a movie like this, a heist movie that has certain things that are kept secret from you until they choose to reveal it. And it allows you to delight in some of the nuances and details that you didn't realize were there the whole time. But one of the things with her character that I really appreciated, Tammy, that's Sarah Paulson's character, was the way that they allowed her environment and her interactions with the other women to tell you a lot about her without her saying it herself. They actually wove it into the subtext of her character, which with a lot of the other characters, including Debbie Lotion, Sandra Bullock's character, there was a lot that was explicitly stated so that you understood what was true about her. With Tammy, you don't get told so much as you get shown quite a few things. And I think that that is actually a higher level of storytelling, to not have to beat people over the head with the details. You just see what you see, you deduce what you deduce from their interactions with other characters, and it enriches your experience of who they are and the role that they're playing.
True. Mm-hmm. One of the last people that we kind of mentioned earlier that we weren't too sure about was Awkwafina, who plays the, what is she? She's like a street con, ultimately.
Yeah, she's the, what are they called? Where they just, you know, they take jewelry off your hand when you're not watching.
Pickpockets?
Pickpocket.
Yeah, pickpocket.
There you go. Good job, Spence.
Yeah, I'm still here.
I was looking at her work, her previous stuff, and she's honestly only been around in terms of mainstream media for the last 2 years, two, three years. Spencer mentioned earlier she did a voice for Storks, which was in 2016. She was in Neighbors 2, which was in 2016. She did a voice role in 2015. Everything else is just really small bits. So she's pretty fresh to the cinematic scene in terms of being on screen. But I mean, I'm hoping with a name like Awkwafina, I'm really hoping that everything that she was doing in the film was kind of part of the act. Because if that's so, she's a really great actress if she can pull that and really do, you know, this role as she did. But I don't have enough personally to base what she would look outside of this. So I think she played a good, you know, street con. I don't know many of them, but she looked like the type that, you know, in terms of this film, that seemed to be that shifty kind of untrustworthy type of person. If you were in the room with her, you'd make sure to check your wallet and your pockets to make sure everything was still there when she left. That's the kind of vibe that I got from her.
Yeah, I mean, she's kind of a bit of a, like a wispy, you know, I mean, she's got this whole like street vibe that seems like it's an affected personality in terms of like she's putting on airs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's very skater boy, tomboyish, doesn't want to be classified by the other characters, you know, in terms of, you know, don't look too far under the surface, too deep under the hood to see what's going on there. Just accept me as I am and you know, whatever. But it's interesting that they... she's the one performer that I was totally unfamiliar with in terms of the eight, you know, never having really seen her in anything before. So it was interesting just this as an introduction. It's a huge introduction.
Yeah.
In terms of Awkwafina, the performer, being placed in context with these other established actresses.
And some of the strongest female actresses in Hollywood right now, currently.
Sure.
Obviously, aside from their team, you also had Anne Hathaway's character, who played this very, very uppity type of actress who is going to the Met Gala.
She's going to be hosting the Met Gala.
Yes.
There, you know, because there's always a celebrity host. Apparently, I don't really follow the Met Gala. I've heard of it. I have heard of it.
I was
not make this thing up. It's actually a real life thing. So I was too, impressed by that.
No, and I've heard of it, but I was actually going to lean more on Chad because I figured you knew more about it than I did.
Well, I mean, that's where the whole, you know, Taylor Swift and Tom Hiddleston thing happened.
Oh, really?
Years ago, they danced and then, yeah.
Wow.
Then Calvin Harris was out. Tom Hiddleston was in, and now Tommy Boy's been out for a while too. So
did you learn that from your sister?
I learned that actually when you and your wife and I were vacationing in Sydney, Australia, and they did a live feed of the Qantas airplane from LA, direct flight, landing at the Gold Coast Airport.
Uh-huh.
They did it live on the National Today Show style show because Taylor Swift and Tom Hiddleston were vacationing together. And that's where they, while they're waiting for the plane to taxi to the terminal and see if you can catch them exiting the plane on camera, they were going through the whole, like, how they got together and whatever. So that's how I know that. I'm not, like, my sister's a huge Taylor Swift fan.
Yeah,
but
that's why it was weird.
I don't really follow Tay-Tay, but I was always up earlier than the two of you were.
Yeah.
At the Airbnb style place we were staying. So I just turned on the TV and I happened to see it for, I don't know, 45 minutes.
Well, there you go. So in terms of,
anyway, that was the Met Gala. And they actually, the Met Gala happens in May. And so this year's Met Gala just happened recently. I couldn't tell you what the theme was, but it's a real thing. All the women who are listening are like rolling their eyes, face palming, like, why are you guys talking about this by yourselves?
We
hear you.
We hear you. We're guys. I mean, we don't know this stuff.
We don't want to give too much away.
Exactly. For the sake, in the name
including the dresses and the shoes and the gowns and the handbags and the whatever. I mean, there's just so much to see.
There was.
There is so much to see, and it looks ridiculous. I just pulled up the most recent Met Gala pictures. Yeah, this is not something for me.
Are you sure?
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
What are you looking at over there?
This woman who looks like she was wearing a poster.
It's called art, Spencer.
I know, but it's subjective, very subjective.
Well, as we mentioned, Anne Hathaway plays the actress, the uppity actress who is set to host the Met Gala.
Yes.
She is this, she's ultimately the target in the film, which we've mentioned earlier. She will be wearing this, she's planning to wear this really large diamond necklace and they're going to steal it in so many ways. So she plays that role, if you
sure.
will. Am I missing anybody else? Richard Armitage is somebody who you can, he's not really important.
He's here and there. He's a man from Debbie Ocean's past. He's an artist, a visual artist. And so he comes and goes in the story.
And then obviously from the trailers, which you would think from the trailers, it seems like there was a much bigger role for this particular individual, but James Corden has a role in this film, late night talk show host. He plays an insurance investigator, whatever. But I sadly, he doesn't have a much larger role in this film, which I felt was my issue with his particular role, which we talked about right after the film was over. I said, I think I could have done without it because I didn't think I had enough of it. I felt like there could have been more to expound upon.
Yeah. And the interesting thing for me is I didn't know there was so much movie left. By the time
exactly.
he showed up, I was like, there's another part of this whole story. And so I enjoyed that they reserved him until that part because him showing up was the signal that I was going to be sitting in my seat for quite a while longer. And at least he's entertaining. So I enjoyed him popping in because I thought that the movie was almost over.
Yeah, that was actually kind of nice because once he shows up, I'm like, I thought we were leaving the theater now.
Yes, absolutely.
Here's kind of great. I think in all honesty, here's the reason why I don't know. I wasn't too happy with how they used him. I was hoping that James Corden would have played the Terry Benedict role or the Willie Banks Al Pacino role, like the man in the security room watching this stuff happening while it unfolds before his eyes and he has no ability to stop it, that kind of thing. Like, I wanted him to be like the outlandish James Corden, not just
the reacting person.
And I think I half expected that seeing him in the trailers because I'd be like, oh, that'd be so much fun to see James Corden act like he's losing all this money in the world and he can't figure out where.
I mean, in a way, that is what he does. It just isn't in the moment.
Yeah.
It's more like retrospectively, he is kind of doing that.
Well, it's a bit different because since he's an insurance adjuster, this isn't directly affecting him. It's just something he's handling.
True.
Yeah. And I think for me that was my, I guess going back to expectations, because I didn't want to jump the gun, but I think that was also one of the expectations that I had for this film was expecting James Corden to have a much more profound or at least pronounced
role. It does bring up an interesting point because unlike at least the first couple, I don't really remember Ocean's 13 over much. I did watch it at some point, but
Spencer
I don't remember
saw it the day before.
But there's no real bad guy. They're not in the others, you're stealing. It's almost like a Robin Hood situation, right? Where you're actually killing two birds with one stone. You're making a lot of money and you're sticking it to somebody who, deserves to be, have revenge against them or whatever. There is a revenge element to part of the story, but they're not getting revenge on Cartier, which is the owners of this necklace. So the necklace itself being stolen, presumably successfully stolen, that's not really they're not sticking it to Cartier. That's just the object. That's just the target piece. That the person that then is part of the revenge plot has really nothing to do with.
Yeah. It's funny because I think drawing back similarities to the previous films, I think this film really parallels Ocean's 11 very well maybe not so much in style and in terms of like the theme and whatnot, but in terms of an Ocean comes out of jail, not breaks, but gets out of jail and meets with his right-hand person, i.e. Rusty or Kate Blanchett's character,
Lou,
assembles a team because the Ocean individual has been concocting a plan while in prison, and then gets together and there's a subplot and they execute this precision type plan and try to rob whomever. But I do think that's where the deviation does occur in terms of the focus of this particular film is not to stick it from the people whose property owns the property.
It's interesting. I don't remember the exact mechanics from Ocean's 11. But obviously this movie we just saw a day ago before recording this episode. I was wondering, like, when in knowing that Debbie Ocean, Sandra Bullock's character, is plotting while in prison, getting out on parole, like, I was sitting there, you know, as the movie's going along, and I'm thinking, well, how does she know that this valuable necklace is going to be worn by this specific person in the year that she gets out on parole? Like, how does she know it? And I went in with that question. I'm glad with the answer that you get in the film, which basically is that she and her team arrange for the necklace to be
worn
there in the first place. Like, the necklace is not that the necklace is also a decision that the con artists make.
Yeah.
And pull different levers and whatnot to accomplish that part of the plan. So they have to find a reason to bring this necklace out of the vault, put it onto this unsuspecting uppity actress's neck, and then steal it from her. So that was, I enjoyed seeing that it wasn't so convenient. I expected oh, how convenient that you knew these things. Like, you knew somebody who informed on something else and whatever because of your connections.
Yeah.
That's not actually the way that it plays out. That it actually is part of the plan that they have. And you see them executing the early parts of the plan in order to get the necklace out into the open.
It's more logistical rather than just out of convenience, which that would have made for, in my mind, which is something we talk about here all the time, lazy story writing.
It totally would have, yeah.
Because I think honestly, had that been the case, I think I may have checked out. I would have checked out early because of the fact that it's like, oh, well, they're just kind of banking on, well, maybe this person will wear it. Well, this person's trending and they'll think about the diamond and then all of a sudden they'll wear the diamond and that's how we're going to plan it.
Yeah.
That would have been a very uncreative way to, like, explain it. Like, the way they do it in the movie is perfect because, you know, it's all like, well, how do we do this? And, like, you know, manipulating people into just the right pattern to get what you want. And that's why it's pretty good.
It also helps to pace out your introduction to certain side character elements of the eight, right? So, like, certain players in that group of eight are more important early on, and so you get a more thorough introduction to them before you really need to know too much about some of the other ones.
True. But going back to those similarities, I think one of the things, like going back to what you had said earlier, recognizing that the target is not...
Notice he said you, but he didn't specify which one. I think we're the same person.
I'm crossing my eyes again. Something that Chad had said, I think that's one of the key things in terms of recognizing that the item being stolen is not... The fact that it's being stolen is not hurting the actual target of the entire plot, the entire plan, the entire heist. And I don't know if that cheapens or has any effect on the overall idea of the heist in my mind, because like we said in previous Ocean's films, the mark is usually the person who will be losing out.
Yes, like you're stealing from someone who deserves to be stolen from.
Exactly. They stole from Terry Benedict because he's just a really bad dude, and he is the person who is currently with Danny Ocean's ex-wife. You know, in the second film, you know, they're stealing to stay alive. The third film, they're stealing because of the fact that this guy almost killed their partner. You look at all that, and there's a purpose and a plan, and the only people who are going to get hurt are the people that deserve in their eyes.
And it's already personal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in this aspect, I think the fact that because Cartier loses out, I think for me, it kind of...
Allegedly
or doesn't. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that, you know?
It does. It makes it a little more... It removes the sense of justice.
Yeah.
Because in a way, you felt like the mark, the target, you know, whatever, in the first three, like, they deserved what was coming to them.
Mm-hmm.
And in this regard, you do feel the same for the target of the revenge plot. But again, Cartier is not the target of the revenge plot. Cartier is just the company that's going to lose hundreds of millions of dollars worth of very fancy, very old diamond jewelry if everything comes off as planned.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more arbitrariness to the thievery component here, where it's just like, oh no, that's just for them to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Doing something despicable that they should be caught, prosecuted, and thrown in prison for the rest of their lives for doing. There's no heroic element to the heist itself.
There's no heart to the heist. If there ever is any in any of these particular films, there's no heart to the endeavor that they're trying to...
Yeah, and the person that you're getting comeuppance on in this case has no connection
Mm-mm.
to the necklace or yeah. to the Cartier family or anything.
No. Like, if there was, like, some type of lineage to this particular individual or this particular group of individuals that were the target and, you know... they were in line to inherit this or whatever. If there was that type of connection, that would have added that element of, oh, okay, so this is why they went that route and they chose to do this and so forth if everything plans out. But then what happens now is that there's people whose jobs are on the line. There's individuals who will be suffering from the ramifications of this, you know, theft. And they didn't really deserve it. And in my mind, I don't know if that differentiates between, allows it to, do you follow, Spencer?
Yeah, I follow, but I feel like that's kind of realistic. That's how crime is sometimes.
Sure.
It's just like.
True.
Yeah.
I agree.
You have a really expensive thing. I'm going to steal it from you.
True, but then we have
you don't to, matter to me. I don't care
yeah.
who you are.
But the idea, though, is that this is supposed to be a part of that franchise. Now, I mean, mind you, this could be just...
It's just a different dynamic. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It is something that differentiates this film and this story from the other three, for sure.
Plus then you're also saying that, like, rich people have a problem with your family and friends if they keep going after you, like, into mm-hmm. where you need to, like, well, we've got to steal back grandma's pudding recipe or something.
I love that you went there. Grandma's I want pudding now.
Pudding recipe?
Can we end this show and just go like find some pudding somewhere? No.
What the heck? Of all the things you could have said, you could have said things much more valuable.
I have no idea where pudding came from.
Don't worry, Spence. I'm on your wavelength. No, it complicates things, yeah. honestly, because in the other films, like once the heist happens or doesn't happen the way you thought it would or, you know, whatever happens, really it's about the personal stakes. Like
yeah.
it's about the getting back at the bad person and your team are all heroes in a Robin Hood kind of sense.
Yeah.
In this one, you get to a point, I didn't realize what they were going to do once they had the necklace. I've never really thought that far ahead to like, are they just going to sell it on the black market? Are they, how are they making money? Because it's so prominent, like it's such a well-known piece. And then once they start, you know, well, assuming they obtain the necklace, then once they do something with the necklace to get money, that was far more complicated in the back quarter of the movie than I was prepared to pay attention to. I think that because it's not a simple, like, and here's the revenge plot, and that's done, and I feel better, and I'm leaving the movie, and, you know, cracking a smile at these people for being so clever. There was just a lot of, when I thought the movie was over, it suddenly became more complex, not in like a, not in the sense of like an intrigue thriller kind of story. It was still very lighthearted.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't prepared to think through the additional level, like the additional people that they hire at the end to try to help them with stuff. There were several levels of added depth, I guess you could say, complex, just more hoops to jump through. Really, it's not complexity in a good way necessarily. No. It's just like it suddenly became more complicated right at the very end, and I didn't realize that the movie wasn't over yet.
Well, it's a bit different from the other ones because in the other ones they're stealing cash generally. This one, it's a thing.
Yeah,
and it kind of makes sense why they were able to like disperse it rather easily because it's been locked up in a vault for 50 years. I don't think like tons of people would be able to identify bits and pieces of a really expensive object.
Well, true, but you can grade certain diamonds. You can find the year or the age on a diamond by, you know, its grading, by its ability to grade. So that's one aspect. But I think here's the thing. Here's the thing that differentiates it between the original trilogy. You have all your complexity in that final third, that final act, as the film is coming down and everything is being revealed to the person who is getting robbed, as the person is the thoughts are unveiling in their mind as to how this thing has actually transpired, or recognizing, you know, the dominoes that have fallen were put in place specifically, and the complexity of everything about the plan is then laid out so that you, as the individual, you're looking through the perspective of the person who's being robbed, seeing how all of this happens. The complexity irons out and it lands with this smug grin or this, you know, sigh of satisfaction within the team, and they go. And that's how the first three films end. You know, that's how that follows up and resolves. This one, like Chad was saying, has that a little bit of complexity as their heist is either successful or unsuccessful. And then as everything you think is done, it actually lifts back up and jumps into the air for a good another 100, you know, 2,000 feet.
Suddenly you have to pay close attention again. Like the reveals in the original movies, well, not the original movies, the modernized adaptation films, the George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, etc. et al. Bernie Mac, may he rest in peace.
Bernie Mac.
Love that guy. That sort of dynamic, you kind of always had sort of the story within the story that you didn't realize was happening at the same time, and oh, isn't that clever. Here you do have a story within a story element, but then you also have a really complicated A story.
Yeah.
Finishing the A story, we've presumably succeeded at swiping this necklace. So finishing that whole sequence of what happens with that and then revealing another level of texture and depth to the storyline that you didn't realize was even happening, which is definitely something the other films have done.
Yeah.
Usually by the time you're revealing the fun secret element, the main thing is wrapped up. Like, there's not a lot of complexity. They're dividing up the money, and then you learn something else that's true that's been going on at the same time. Here, they're not really dividing up money. They're still finishing the job.
Yeah.
And you're getting to know that there's another level of complexity to what's been happening the whole time. So it's a lot of information at, for us, you know, just around 9:30 p.m. at the end of the 2-hour experience. Like, it's a lot of information to suddenly turn your brain back on and say, oh, okay, I do actually need to pay attention, or I'll just leave the movie theater with a confused look on my face. It's a lot to, instead of front loading you, they back load you. And I just wasn't expecting that dynamic.
And mind you, this is not to say that it's a bad dynamic. It's not to say that, you know, it makes the film worse. We're not jumping on that. It's just that there's a format, there's a formula, there's a style, and especially with what has already been laid out for this franchise, particularly, there's already kind of the formula that's been set by, you know, Steven Soderbergh and what he's done with the original, the modernized trilogy. And so kind of deviating from that, yes, this is totally separate, but I don't know, that re-jumping back into the complexity of the storyline does add an added element that I don't know if fans are going to be happy with. Like, when people are watching all this and they're like, oh my gosh, okay, this was great. Oh, okay, cool. All the complex stuff is done. And then the rocket has to jump back up and you got to pay attention all over again. It's too much, might be too much.
Yeah, because you're sitting there thinking, okay, how are they going to do this? And they're mapping out how they're going to do this. But then they get to the point where they possibly accomplish their goal. And then you're sitting there thinking, wait, how are they going to do this? Like, how are they going to finish the job? And you've got more characters coming into play in the back quarter of the film, yeah, which almost never happens unless they're like, you know, the deus ex machina, you know, kind of way of fixing something that wasn't, you know, shouldn't have been broken in the first place, which is not exactly what James Corden is even doing here.
No.
But, you know, he doesn't appear until the very end of the movie. When you think the movie's over, suddenly there he is, and there's a whole other thing that happens. You know, but you're expecting to turn the brain off and you turn it back on. Also, you've already by this point been kind of in a way dazzled into submission, I want to say, because since this is set at the Met Gala, you've got, and it's set in the real world, like the Met Gala is a real thing. Mm-hmm. They're at the Met. The sets that they're using replicate the Met Museum itself. They might have filmed in the Met. I don't know. I doubt it. That usually does not happen, but maybe they did. But then they're name dropping a bunch of celebrities who would be on the guest list. You're looking at table settings. There are a number of celebrity cameos that you don't know until you see them, you know, what's going on. And then you've got a number of other cameos that are people that I wouldn't consider celebrities, but some people will know their names. So there's just, you've taken in a lot of information by the time the heist is even happening. It, like the heist itself, by the time that's going on, you've processed a lot of information.
It's true.
Actually, like with the back half of this, I was actually really impressed with it, because usually, like, I feel like a movie like this would be like, oh, they got the diamonds and then yada, 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 they got the money from it somehow. But like,
we don't talk about that. Just they did it. It worked.
Credits.
Yeah.
But to actually like have them be like, oh no, all this other stuff is happening. I was like, oh, I was not expecting this, and I'm still here for it. Let's see where this is going. I thought it was kind of cool.
Huh. Well, with all that, let's go ahead and go around the table and talk about whether or not this film passes or fails, and how many monocles. Let's start with Spencer. Does it pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Definitely passes for me. I thought it was pretty well done. You know, acting was pretty good, even from Rihanna, which I was surprised when I was like, oh, this is fine and not terrible. So great job, everyone, really. So I'll give it 3.5. I think it was pretty good.
What about you, Jen?
Yeah, I would also say that it passes. Making my brain do extra work at the end is not a reason to fail a film. Mm-hmm. I think that there are far too many films that do fail because they don't challenge you to think in any way. But I would say I would agree. It's not like a 5 monocle pass. It's more of a 3.5. I will give it props for one thing that we haven't really talked about, but the musical cues. That's definitely a trope of the Oceans series under Soderbergh. And he did executive produce this one as well, even though he did not direct it. And the music has some several standout moments. And just the overall, like, I don't know, the zhuzh, the vibe, the scene transitions and things kind of have a liveliness to them like you're used to seeing in the other films in this franchise. So I appreciated that. I also... there was a really fun, for me, cameo from a member of the original cast. Not the original, the Steven Soderbergh set. There's a character, there might be more than one, There's one particular character from the Ocean's 11, 12, 13 set of characters that I really appreciated seeing.
There you go. As for myself, the film does pass with all the little minor hiccups. Like Chad said, even though this film is not a five monocle type of pass, it does get kudos for what it does and what it sets out to do. It's extremely entertaining, which is what you want in a film like this. You want it to be entertaining. You want it to be engaging, even if at the last 20, 25 minutes of the film is still making you think, hey, by all means, I'd rather have that than have a non-engaged film throughout the entire thing. So I'm going to give
it... Or a cheap ending, like Spencer was talking about, that falls flat, and you're like, oh, so they just...
Rode off into the sunset.
Okay, fine.
I give it 3.5 monocles out of 5, and yeah. So if you get a chance to see it, check it out this weekend. It debuts this Thursday night or this Friday, however, whenever you decide to go see your films. So check out your local theater for the listings, and we'd love to hear what you thought about it. So drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. This was a great conversation, and like we said, we'd love to hear your thoughts. So, yeah, that's about it.
So tell us your thoughts.
Tell us your thoughts.
On our social media pages, like facebook.com/filmlosophers.
All right.
Way to stick the landing, guys.
There we go. Well, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.